Reading from the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, chapter 1, text 25. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sri Jamani Uvacha Maturevam Maharamya. Prashnena Nandita Sutta Tamnatva Sastru Romancham Arepe Pratibhashitam. Sri Jaimini said, delighted by this most pleasing inquiry from Mother Uttara, her son Brikshit bowed down to her and began his reply. Tears poured from his eyes and his hair stood on end. Commentary. Prickshit will begin his reply by complimenting his mother for her excellent question and by offering respects to his worshipable Lord. Om Gyanati Marandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Taksur Nutam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Vairagya Yugbhakti Risham Piyatnai Apayam Amanabhikshamandham Kripam Buhiya Paradhuka Dhuki Sanatanastham Prabhumasriyami. Vancha kapa tarubhyascha kripa sindhu bhayevacha patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Greetings from Sridham Mayapur. I just basically came from my other class. Very charming group of people. So let's get into the text. Jaimini Rishi is speaking to Janamejaya. Actually, it's a commentary on a second version of the Mahabharata that is even deals with something a little bit more deeper than the Mahabharata we have, which is basically Dharma. And there's another Mahabharata which highlights, it's spiritual history, but highlights Parodharma. And he's narrating this story of Maharaj Prickett summarizing the Bhagavatam to his mother on the last day of his life. And you can imagine how much realization that has. I often quote Ernest Hemingway, where he says, I'm sorry the letter was so long, but I didn't have the time to write it. It means when communication is effective and realization has a lot to do with your ability to communicate, your ability to understand things deeply allow you to express them eloquently. And eloquently means clearly and concisely. So in that depth of realization, he's able to um, summarize the Bhagavatam in a very interesting way. Because the Bhagavatam ultimately is a message. And communication entails changing the form of the message to accommodate the understanding of the audience. So he's giving the essence of the Bhagavatam, and it has kind of a different form, but it really has the same message. And the message is bhakti. And to help explain bhakti, bhakti itself is described in different forms. This was just described. Jnana bhakti, Shuddha bhakti, Premi bhakti, Premaptura bhakti. Different levels of bhakti and expressions of bhakti and intimacy. And when you deeply understand that concept of bhakti, then you can understand that the purest and most forceful expression of bhakti is to Krishna. Because there's no there's no obligation or duty external to bhakti mixed in from the gopis who have the most intense form of bhakti. And that's basically the message of the Bhagavatam. It's progressive. But it goes to that point to help you understand that point and actually promote that point. So it's done in two ways here. One, in Narada's gradation of devotees, which culminates in the devotees of Vrindavan. And now we'll hear the story of Gop Kumar and his gradation of places, which culminates in Vrindavan. And the correlation is there between the place and the consciousness, both in material gradation of purity of desire, becoming detached, and elevation of place. And then when you get to the spiritual realm, then there's a correlation between intimacy and force of love and exaltation of the place. So now, in Uttara's expression to Maharaj Prickin, this is also a very important point. The teacher can help the student according to his understanding of the student's capacity to learn, which is revealed by these students, the questions that the student asks, and by the exposition of knowledge that he shares. So that's what Uttara did. She's explaining her understanding of the correlation between consciousness and place. And then when you get to the spiritual world, the consciousness is love. So it's a correlation between your degree of love or the form of love or the intimacy of the love and the facility that a place offers to exchange that love. And she really, really wants to understand the place where the highest love is expressed, because understanding the place helps you to understand that love. Because the place is only manifest to express and facilitate a particular type of love. Even in this world, every place that we have is an expression of a particular type of love we want to exchange, because that's what we are. By nature, we are loving. That is our nitya dharma. That is our eternal function. Our eternal function is to love. And the height of love requires an environment that supports that love. And you know, environment and consciousness is very, very interrelated. Your consciousness creates your environment, and your environment creates your consciousness, materially and spiritually. And this book is Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which professes a particular conception of reality, of love and devotion, in its most spontaneous way, in Vrindavan, with the most intimate people, the gopis, as the culmination and height of the expression of Godhead. That's what this book is about. It's about that from the terms of Narada's search for the highest devotee and going through gradations of devotees who are higher and higher in love, and now it'll go through Gopa Kumar. So that's what Uttara asked, and it culminated in a kind of a yearning within her, because, you know, this is written 500 years ago, and the types of expression of bhakti that come from Madhavendra Puri through Lord Chaitanya were very, very hidden and very, very esoteric. It's kind of, we came to spiritual life through Krishna consciousness, so it seems like a very common and prevalent view. But it wasn't so common and prevalent when Lord Chaitanya began to preach. So it's not surprising that even to Uttara, who is the mother of Marge Prickett and not from Vrindavan, that she's trying to figure these things out. Okay, I heard about the highest devotees. Except they're the highest devotees. Now, what is their place? And then she began to question about Mathura here in the world and had some doubts about its eternality and even its purity, because you can still have doubts because it's externally covered. So these points are actually going to be resolved, that the highest place is Goloka, because it is there where there is the fullest expression of Godhead. It facilitates the revelation of God's heart and love, which only happens in the environment of Vrindavan among the most intimate devotees, the gopis. So she's really asking about that place. And Marge Prickett is very, very ecstatic, anandita. He's delighted by the Maharamya Prashnena, by the Maharamya, the most pleasing question. And the value of a question is in the quality of the answer to that question. And because her question is actually asking, questions and answers are, there's a question. If there's a question, there's an answer. If you give the answer, you don't have to say what the question is. If you give the question, then the answer is automatically implied. So because it's asking Maharaj Prickett to discuss and reveal the highest things, It's in engaging his mind and thoughts in the highest, which is love, and which is feelings of love for the one that whom one loves. So therefore, Marge Prickett, who we'll see, who is such an incredible devotee, his consciousness is Krishna consciousness, because those are his attachments or desires. He has a desire for Krishna, and therefore he's always seeking the object of Krishna to fulfill that desire. And that desire is very strong. And when that desire is love, there is nothing one likes to do more than to express that love through the glorification of one's beloved. And he is Mahabhagavat. So he's in ecstasy. It shakes him up. It just, his mind just becomes overwhelmed with love. We see that happen, that people can't speak about certain things without having a powerful emotional reaction, especially someone they love in separation. So tears are pouring from his eyes, and his bodily hairs stood on end. These are Satvika Bhavas. So he's telling this story, and Parikshit bows down and begins his reply. Sri Parikshit Uvacha, Sri Krishna Jiva Dema Das Tadiya Virahat. Tavaiva yogya prashnoyam nakrito yaschakastinat. Prikshit said, my dear mother, for you who live only for Krishna, separation from him is intolerable. This question of yours is most praiseworthy. No one has ever asked this question before. So we're getting into very, very deep and esoteric things, and they're very, very sweet. And when someone asks about those things, who's qualified to hear about those things, from the speaker who's qualified to explain them, that is rasa. That is rasa. Because within those questions and in those answers is Krishna and the feelings of the devotee and their exchange. So he's really glorifying the question, because the answer to the question is so glorious. And specially glorious according to his own bhava. It's feeling what he loves the most. And he's also indicating the glories of his mother. Funny, you know, I'm over here in the Vaishnava Academy, and the Jalungi River, and then across it is these towns. And the local residents have a culture. It's not their traditional culture. A blasting loud music. It's the only thing in Mayapur that's a little challenging. And for me, I've just been earplugs, you know, it just happens occasionally. But when I'm giving class, it's a special challenge. But I manage, I always do. My machine went off, just 1 second. So, he's questioning his mother, Yogi Prashna. It's a praiseworthy question, and it's so deep it's never been asked before. And you're so qualified to hear the answer. And he's also encouraging her to listen. Sometimes for us to have attention, we have to activate the buddhi or intelligence beyond how we feel about something. We have to understand the importance, and then we apply our mind. The Krishna consciousness, the application of the mind to Krishna. But the mind is under the control of the intelligence, not just how we feel, but what we understand is true. So sometimes in a discussion, the teacher will indicate in various ways the importance of the discussion and will encourage for the purpose of encouraging the student to listen attentively. Because the teacher has so much faith that what he's about to deliver can have so much positive effect that he wants to make sure the person is attentive so that they can benefit from the description and instruction. Because hearing or seeing is not just a sensual experience. The hearing or seeing depends on the focus of the mind on what comes through the senses. And if the mind is not focused on what comes through the senses, even if something comes through the ear, we have to question if we are actually hearing. So in any type of yoga process, any type of study, there has to be some kind of determination. An experience, you know, I'm lecturing and my watch broke, because I always get the cheapest watch, and it lasts for about a year. And I was frustrated because I didn't have my watch. And I've been in class for 2 weeks, and I look at the wall in the back, and there's a clock. Now, that must have come through my senses, but I never saw it because my mind wasn't focused at the time that I was looking at it. So here, what's going on here? Wait. One second, I just got to fix something on my... So here, Parikshit is inspiring his mother so that she'll focus, and she calls it Sri Krishna Jivata, which means one who lives only for Krishna, or one whom Krishna brought back to life, because the second meaning, Krishna saved the life of Uttara by stopping the Brahmastra of Ashwatthama. You live only for Krishna, your separation from him is intolerable. living only for Krishna means that that is what your that's your mind. Your mind is so imbued with impressions of Krishna that that is your strongest desire, and that's what love is. Love is an overwhelming, consuming experience that subdues the importance of any other conceptions or desires. That's what the ultimate reality is. The ultimate reality is that overwhelming experience called rasa, completely consumed. That's what your mind is. That's all you want. And therefore, if that's what you want, to be without it is the greatest pain. As the gopis, when they see Krishna in danger, they're tormented and their life becomes zero because Krishna is their life. If you live for Krishna, Krishna is your life. Without Krishna, you have no life. That's what separation is. So your love is tested by your reaction to the absence of the object of your beloved. So he's praising the question, but the reason it's so praiseworthy is because of the heart of the person asking the question. They really love Krishna. Sri Krishna Jivita. Krishna is their life, and therefore they are asking the question with a degree of conviction and importance that enthuses the teacher to answer that. So there's some description in the Bhagavatam that's very interesting. It's from the first canto, the 10th chapter. And it's describing all the great devotees of Krishna, all the great ladies, when Krishna is leaving Hastinapur for Dwarka. And how they fainted because it was impossible for them to bear the separation of Krishna. That's what reality is. Reality is love. And love has two embankments. I'm with you, I'm without you. Or I will be with you, or I will be without you. And those conceptions of union and separation inform embankments where the flow of love is so peaceful. And that's what exists in the ultimate reality. That's the prayojana. That's the goal. The goal is to understand God. And not only understand God, but see God. Because there's nothing separate from God. So when you reach a certain level of realization, you actually see God. But because we have a relationship with God, when we become enlightened and we see God, and we see God everywhere, we feel God, we feel our attachment. It's so natural because we're part of God. And our intrinsic nature is for God, because that's what it means to be part of something. When you're part of something, then by constitution you're for that thing. But because these parts are conscious, being for Krishna means to please and love Krishna. And that is our constitution. That is our nature. It's very, very natural. And because it deals with the ultimate reality. So therefore, the love is of the ultimate quality and force. It's dealing with God. The biggest austerity for me in Mayapur is people are just pulling me like different ways to take lunch at their house. And I have so many really close people. I mean, I have such a nice, because people are coming, 50, 60, 70 people every night coming and hearing. And I'm speaking on 10th Canto and they're deeply appreciating it. So there's a very deep love, and this has been going on for years. There's a very, very deep loving relationship. So yesterday, I was invited for lunch for one godbrother, Nareshwara. And I respect him, especially because of the sons that he raised, which are such nice devotees, and they're running the Gurukul. Both the boys and girls Gurukul, his sons are running it. And they're real kshatriyas, real good managers, and real good character. So, anyway, I went to his house because, you know, starting to do the city planning, and they want to use all the latest technologies of sanitation. And the people that are most cutting edge and proficient in these technologies are people from America. Eco sanitation, where the sanitation just is basically, I guess it works in one way that the sanitation is just basically just fertilizing your gardens or something. I don't know. It's a modern technology. And so somehow or other, I don't know, the people know that I'm the one that brings people from America to the Dham. So he asked me to come over for lunch. And one guy was 24 years old, super intelligent. And maybe it's good this time for a story too. Then the lady, a little bit older, but super educated, intelligent people. And they ask such good questions. So I was taking lunch with them. And one of the persons who's one of the main designers of the new buildings and constructions that are going up is this incredibly saintly Brahmachari. Named Korma Chaitanya. And he's kind of like a very high-class British fellow who studied in the best schools. And I remember when he joined in Vrindavan in the very, very early 80s. And he's the main dresser for the deities in Mayapur. And they're exquisite, Radha Madhava. And he's one of the main cooks. He cooks the cakes every night. But as a very, very balanced person, understanding himself, you know, as he's gotten older, you know, he's made an arrangement where he can get his own little room. And he used to study physics in college, and he's an artist, and he became a very, very good designer. So he designs homes and buildings and never charges anything. And they have to force money upon him because he's a real renunciate. So I remember he started talking and it was very fascinating. And I can remember what he was saying. It was very interesting. He said that Krishna is infinite. So when you take something away from infinity, I never thought of this, actually, but it remains infinity. It remains infinite. Even if you take away something from something that's infinite, it remains infinite. And that's Krishna. Om Purnam Padam, Om Purnam, Purnam Idam Idam, Purnam Purnam. The Supreme Personality of God is perfect and complete. And even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. So he's explaining that it's infinite. And then he was explaining that what mathematics and physics is, it's not reality, it's a representation of reality. And he explained to these people there's a difference. It's a representation of reality. But he said, by definition, God is infinite, and what mathematics and physics are means to describe the finite. So he's explaining, by definition, they're insufficient to explain the ultimate reality. By definition. But anyway, I kind of lost a little bit of track there, but Uttara, it's described because, you know, she's asking these questions and there's such an incredible exchange. We pray to meet such devotees who have that conception idea, and there are people like that, that their only life is Krishna. So that's how Maharaj Prickett is describing his mother. She lives only for Krishna. So here, when this verse in the Bhagavatam describes the list of the people in Hastinapur who are fainting because they can't bear the separation from Krishna. Naturally, that's their attachment. Sanatan here explains that Uttara's name, because it says Uttara, then it says Matsyasutta. And the father of Uttara, who is Virata, was adopted along with his sister Satipirti by a fisherman, Matsya. So Virata was also called Matsya, and therefore Matsyasutta can indicate either Satyavati or it could indicate Satyavati's niece, Uttara, because Satyavati's father is Uttara's, Satyavati's brother is Uttara's father. So what Sanatan is saying, if you take the second of these alternatives, that Uttara is mentioned, then Matsyasutta refers to Uttara, then she's mentioned twice in these verses, indicating that her level of separation is even more intense than the others. So therefore, it's quite appropriate, due to her level of devotional advancement, that she's asking so confidentially about Krishna. Because few people would have that kind of attitude and desire to want to delve so deeply into what is Krishna. So Maharaj Prickett is talking to his mother. Nijapriya sakasyatra Sri Subhadra patiraham yena potra tayagarbhe tava sajjanma labhita. Krishna himself granted me the fortunate privilege to be born here from your womb as a grandson of his dear friend Arjuna. Because his grandson of Arjuna, Arjuna's Arjuna's son is Abhimanyu, who's the father of Prikshit. I'm so fortunate, he's saying. It's a privilege. And it's so nice when you feel something is fortunate or a privilege. It's the basis of spiritual life. Because only if you have that consciousness can you appreciate things, love things, love people, and feel that love. So this is natural for a great devotee. He's grateful, just like the residents of Govardhan, even they were worshiping Govardhan Hill, and obviously it wasn't the highest thing and Krishna stopped it, but it showed what a cultured and simple people are. They are grateful people. And that you can't separate gratitude from humility. A proud person is not grateful. And a humble person is not ungrateful. And these are the core qualities of love that form the basis of the foundation where we can deepen our love to higher and more intimate senses of love with the speak of Braja Bhakti. But we access it now through core feelings of expression of love of the soul, which is humility, which is gratitude, which is compassion, which is surrender. So he says, I got the fortunate privilege. He's feeling mercy. I did not deserve. So when you feel mercy, it's an experience of love. And that's how the devotee's consciousness is always imbued in love. Because he really does not take anything for granted. Nama Shreshtam Manumapi Sachi Putram Atrasarupam Rupam Tasya Gajam Uruparim Matara Goshtavatim Varakundam Girivaram Maharika Maravasam Prapto yasya pratita kripaya shri guru tam natosmi. Raghunath Das Goswami, he's appreciating. Nama shreshtum. That I, by the mercy of God and Guru, I have gotten the best thing, the holy name. Madhumapi and the Gayatri mantras. Nama Shreshtam Anumapi Sachi Bhutam and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Atra Sarupam and Sri Damodar Ramananda Roy Rupam Sri Rupa Goswami Tasya Gajam and his brother Uru Parim Matara Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaram Maho Radha Kundam Girivaram Maho Radha Kundam Girivaram Maho. They're fortunate. I appreciate. I value. And therefore I'm feeling your love because of the value of what you're giving me out of kindness. Commentary, Prikshit realizes that only by the special mercy of Krishna will he be able to answer his mother's question. And accordingly, he offers his homage to Krishna. So this is to explain Krishna, the unlimited nature of Krishna. You have to be inspired. You have to be inspired. You have to love. And he's offering homage to express his humility. to his acknowledgement of mercy, which is an acknowledgement of the value you ascribe to spiritual phenomena. In text 27-31, he first describes the favor shown by Krishna in his life. This first word, utra, here, indicates several meanings. What does it mean, here? Fortunate to be born here. Utra, here. I'm fortunate to be here. Where? The holy land of Bhartvarsha, Bharate Bhumite Hoila Manushya Janma Yara Janma Sartakara Kara Parupakara Bharate Bhumite Hoila Manushya. Human form of life is rare. What to speak of being born in India? So he was born in the most pious central region in the human species in a dynasty of great Kshatriyas and from the womb of Uttara as the grandson of Krishna's friend, Arjuna. So Uttara, here. I'm fortunate to be here in so many ways. And his birth was sat, it's described, satjanma. It's auspicious. Why? Because the birth is connected with Krishna. That's what being auspicious. Something is auspicious if somehow it's bringing you closer to the soul. Whether or not you're accepting an attachment or whether or not you're rejecting an attachment, what becomes auspicious is what brings you closer to Krishna. That's why when someone becomes a devotee, his whole perspective on his destiny changes. Because he views destiny, all destiny, good and bad, as bringing one closer to Krishna. And sometimes the difficulties are, he doesn't judge them bad, because they're bringing him closer to Krishna. Because real happiness is not moving the world to suit our desires, but changing our desires to suit the world. And how do you change your desires to suit the world? By a mood of service. You have a mood of service, then the world makes sense, because the world is just an opportunity for service. So when one has that bhava, that mood of service, which is what a devotee is, he really transcends good and bad. Because if that's your value system, there is nothing good or bad. If your happiness is based in things, you can be distressed. But if it's based on your desire, that's within your control. So sat, auspicious, because he was connected with Krishna. From the very beginning, Krishna prevented his mother's womb from being aborted. So it's auspicious. Are there any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hey, Gil. Hi, Bo. Hi, Bo.
Hi, Bo. Just one little question. Can you just elaborate on what is more prevalent in our understanding today than what was prevalent during Utero's time. Remember you were saying?
I don't remember.
You're saying that, you know, we take for granted so much knowledge, you know, about like the destination of the various devotees, types of devotees, various types of bhaktas, you know. But I guess 500 years ago, this knowledge wasn't so prevalent.
I got it.
Okay.
Yeah, I got it. What I'm saying is, you know, when Lord Chaitanya appeared, right, the concept of Radha and Krishna, right, was not deeply understood, right? It wasn't, that was revealed by, basically, or made prominent by the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the fact that she's not knowing this is not surprising, because it was not known at the time. But from our projection, you know, she's such a great devotee, how come she doesn't know these things? Because we know them. It's been made, we've come to Krishna consciousness, and we know about Vrindavan. We know about Radha and Krishna. We know about the supremacy of Radha and Krishna, because it was revealed then and then explained and propagated and written about for, you know, centuries now. But at that particular time, these things were not known. And therefore, when it describes what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is giving, it says, Anarpita Charin Charat Kunaya Bhatir Nasa Kalo. Anarpita Charin Charat Sakunaya Bhatir.
Hi, Bo.
Yeah. Oh, who's talking there in the background there?
I'm sorry, Mara. I'm having trouble finding a quiet spot. I'm in the Penn Station.
You really do.
Hmm?
You're really having a... Where are you?
I'm in Penn Station.
Oh, okay. I can understand. Okay.
I'm trying to mute.
Okay. Anarpita charim charat kununayabha tirna kalo samarpiyatam unatojvala rasham shabak. Anarpita. Arpita means given. Anarpita. Charim charat. For a very long time, this was not given before. So at that time, anarpita charim charat kununayabha tirna kalo. Only it was given recently. Never before given. So many things, but one of these things are these deep esoteric meanings. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions? Anybody else like to say hello?
Maharaj?
Hi. Hey, Maharaj.
Hi, Maharaj.
Hi, Bo. Hi, Bo. Hey, Carl. Hare Krishna, you're back. How did your group do?
Very well, thank you. We just got back yesterday. Thank you so much for your time.
I was looking forward to you being back on the Sangha.
Looking forward to hearing you.
Thank you. But your young lady did well?
Yes, very well.
Okay. It was so refreshing. This, you know, America has such a bad name. It's just being so loud, you know, because they just meet New Yorkers and people from California. To get some of those kind of homebody, Midwestern girls representing my country. It was great. It was so nice, really. Anyway.
Thank you.
I'll talk about that more. Okay.
Mooney, thank you. They appreciate it much.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
Mark, do you still have time for questions?
Yeah.
You still have a minute for
questions? Yeah, I do.
One thing you brought up at the end is something that I've always found hard to understand exactly how to fit it all in. So you had mentioned that, you know, often the way the world is that it's kind of, and you've made this point a number of times very powerfully, that there's basically two kind of attitudes we could have. One is, I want to mold the world for myself. The other is, I want to conform with the greater reality. And so I'm not so worried about moving the world for myself, but rather, if I see the world through the eyes of service, I think, how can I mold myself? And so and so in that sense, as you said, destiny itself becomes your friend, because whatever the world throws at you can become a vehicle for communing with Krishna through surrender. And I really appreciate that. Even from the time I when I was in India in 1994 with you as a kid, that when you explained in the Bhagavad Gita, that's how you overcome dualities, it finally made sense. And I really appreciate that. What I've always found hard to understand is, if we accept that, it still seems to me that there's a lot of things in the world that we would want to change. And, you know, a standard criticism of the Indian view of karma, and by the way, I think this is a powerful criticism. I don't think it means karma is false, but I think this is a problem in India, is that you can very easily become callous towards other sufferings because you just say, well, hey, yeah, that guy may be born with deformities, but that's his karma. Right? I don't have to give money to fix it. I don't have to somehow help the guy. It's his karma. And so I guess what I'm asking you is, how do you negotiate these two what seem to be true perspectives? One is, we do want to surrender to destiny and try to use it as a way to come to a higher level of spiritual vision. But on the other hand, there are things that I think we want to change in the world, and it's not always just about surrendering to destiny.
Yeah, but the point that was made here is, you look at the world in terms of service. In other words, you're not trying necessarily to change the world for yourself. You know, I mean, your happiness basically no longer becomes moving the world according to your desire, right? What I said, but actually, you see the world and then you serve it. So in every situation, you have choices, and to help others is one of the choices. Now the question is, really becomes, I think it really comes down to it, how much can we help others, right? And it's kind of difficult to help others. So it's not a question of being callous or selfish, you know, because you're supposed to serve. And what does serving mean? It means to serve other people's desires. So obviously, you try to act upon the world. So now I guess the real question comes with karma is, how much can you do that, you know? Or really, why should you do it if it's kind of necessary, right?
If it's kind of what? I'm sorry, I didn't get the last word.
Why should you do it if it's inevitable, right? If it's karma. And, you know, why should you do it? Well, besides the fact that it is your duty to help others, right? But then that makes it seem like it's actually for you. Or the question becomes, you know, you helping others is just kind of a vehicle for their karma. You know what I'm saying? It's not really, you know, if it wasn't you, someone else will do it. You know what I'm saying? In other words, they're destined to be helped. So it's a question of how much free will also impacts the world. you know, I mean, you really have to think deeply about it because, you know, you want to help others and you want to change things. But philosophically, actually, how much do you impact things and how much do you change things? You know, are you just acting as a vehicle for change that's not really happening by you, but you're just becoming the instrument for some? I guess that's it. Well, you know, we should become the instrument for change, but does it really matter? Or will, by karma, some other instrument, you know, somebody else be the instrument for their change, you know? It's a good question. You know, it doesn't stop us from serving, our duty for serving, but how much we actually institute change. I don't know how much we actually institute change. I guess there's five factors of action, and one is the endeavor. I mean, karma is very, very intricate, you know. And when something bad happens to us, you know, we're supposed to look at it as actually God just using the other person as an instrument, you know. So from that perspective, when something is good happening, right, to us, are we supposed to do the same thing? Are we supposed to say that, you know, it's not the person, it's just God? But we do recognize, in one sense, God may be sending people, but we do appreciate the good efforts of people. You know, I guess there's a certain level where you're not supposed to just live on the level of philosophy. You know, that's all I can say. You know, I don't, what can you do? It is reality. There is karma, there is destiny, and we're instruments in prakriti kriyamana ani gunai karmani sha, you know, there's a limit except to what we're the doer. But still, there is an impetus that you can change things. But I guess ultimately it's becoming an instrument for change. You know, how much it actually affects destiny? I don't know. I have to think about that deeply. But we can definitely become instruments for change. What do you feel the problem is? What is the philosophical
No, in a way, like you're bringing up the really deep sort of philosophical questions. I was, and I think it's totally relevant, but I was thinking more just about how, you know, it seems like much of our struggle in spiritual life is just getting the right perspective on the world. You know, it goes beyond, I mean, in one sense, doctrine is secondary to this. It's about retraining our vision just to see the world, you know. And so, on one hand, you had just said something, it was almost like a little maxim or mantra you said that, you know, we shouldn't worry about making the world conform to us, but we should conform to the world. You said something like that. And that's what really this question that, and, you know, it seems to me that quite often that's really a powerful tool for one's own individual spiritual vision. But I think that most of us wouldn't want to live in a society like that, or have a family like that, or have friends like that, or have gurus like that, because we expect other people to take initiative to rectify what they think are problems in the world. And so, anyway, it was that kind of, and so I think what you're bringing up is just the fact that
conform to the world, you know, I said to serve the world.
I thought you had said it a bit more strictly.
I'm just saying, in terms of, it's you're not conforming, what you're not trying to do is change the world to move according to your desires. It basically means your selfish desire. You know, you're not focused on trying to change destiny. You're rather serving destiny. That's what I said. So in terms of serving destiny, I think we do want people there. I mean, the question is how much can you change it even though you're in that attitude? That's the problem. Not that you're not serving. You are serving. And the serving means to try to institute some change, obviously. And you are instituting change, but then what I'm saying is it just gets down to a very deep philosophical point of doership, you know?
Yeah,
and I don't think we live on that deep philosophical platform in one sense, you know?
Well, we don't, but I think we want the way we live to be at least consistent with that, right? I mean, like, there's times where I wondered, when Prabhupada expressed concern for the physical health of his disciples, was that in spite of his philosophy or because of it? You know, if his philosophy is that we're not our body and the only way to help someone is to give them spiritual knowledge, it seems strange that he'd express, and he really did, such genuine, heartfelt concern for, like, the details of his disciples' physical health, you know?
I don't think so, because even on the spiritual platform, it's so connected.
I would think so, but I guess what I'm getting at is, like, you're making the point that there seems to be a disconnect between the philosophy and how we live, and I'm wondering, I understand we're not always going to be thinking about this stuff, but at the least, I think we'd want our kind of our ground level impulses and desires and stuff to at least be consistent with our philosophical beliefs, even if it's not what's always motivating us. I don't know. Marsh, I don't mean to, I mean, this is just something that I've thought about a lot, and I'm sorry, I don't want to kind of, if I could just throw one other thing out there related to this, that's tied to what you just said. I was really struck, I haven't done personally a lot of research on this, but I had read, a fair amount of things on older Indian theories of karma, say going to the Upanishads and things like that. And at least in some of the most influential expressions of this, like in Shankaracharya and others, karma does not always seem to be an all-encompassing thing. So, for example, in a lot of ancient authorities, at least again, I read mostly secondary literature, but if you were murdered, that's not necessarily karma. It's actually a violation of the laws, and the person who murders you is going to get bad karma, but that what karma governs is more limited. It's Janmaishwarya Shruta Shri, you know, things like the kind of family you're born into, the kind of wealth you have, the kind of learning, intelligence you have. And so there's ways in which, like, we have a notion of karma that we operate out of, but it's not like I've seen it really delineated in any systematic way in the Shastra. And so sometimes maybe we incorporate, I don't know, I'm thinking aloud now, but sometimes I wonder if the ideas we bring into it, maybe we don't have to have this notion where it dictates every single event. Maybe there's kind of some more leeway there. Anyway, that came to mind, Marge. Maybe we could talk about it offline. I don't want to co-opt the
interesting, but it's general understanding is that what happens to you, you've caused, you know. So I think philosophy is a problem whichever way you turn it, because if you turn it the other way, you know, then, you know, if someone murders you, right, or someone kills someone else, right, and or does something to someone else, I guess it's just the chance of the universe or something, you know. I mean, what I understand of karma is some kind of moral force that disconnects our actions and reactions. So anyway, I think it's a very deep subject, but we can discuss that further. It's very interesting. I mean, my mind is still thinking of how to wrap myself around, you know, the fact of destiny and, you know, a certain force of destiny, but there's also free will. I mean, it's a little, free will means that you can change the future, obviously. You know, so what destiny means is what's happening to you, you know, or what's moving towards you is beyond your control. But the future is always in your control. So I would say that the same thing in terms of impacting people, you know. What's happening to them is their karma, but their free will have an impact on what their future is, and how you deal with them will have an impact on their future too. You know, and I guess it may be connected to their karma too in a way. I've seen people, learned people discuss karma, you know, and it becomes very intricate because you do something and then it's destined and who destined, you know, it just goes infinite, you know, what kind of influence and will we have. Anyway, it's a deep subject. Okay.
Well, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marie. No, good. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Hey, Mother Indrani, Hare Krishna, Happy New Year, Happy New Year, everyone. Okay?
Yes,
good.
Thank you.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Bo, Maharaj.
Okay, Shastra. Puri Yatra really seems to be getting a nice life of its own now. You know, it's good. Kishore of the Mayapuris is coming now too.
Yeah.
So we're gonna have some really nice kirtaneers. It's really gonna be. I got Guna Grandma's bell tree in my room. We're gonna take it to Mayapur. He's got instruments in every town, you know. It's good. Okay. Okay. Anybody else
Thank
like
you.
To say hello? Okay, let's end now. Vanshakopa Tudjus Shakapas and the Deva Shapatikanam Padrikan.